Fan anger over the Super League boils over. We'll tell you what it was like to witness the unrest at Old Trafford force the postponement of a Premier League match.
We want places, we want places.
Owners are under fire from their own fans, and now the rebel clubs are being punished. We'll have the details about how UEFA's fining them. UEFA also has to decide what's happening to this season's Champions League final. Can it still be played in Istanbul, with Turkey now on England's travel red list? The coronavirus emergency has been extended in Tokyo, but athletes headed to Japan can now get vaccines for the Olympics and Paralympics. Plus, the Super League, that's still on the cards. In golf, we've got it all analysed on this week's Sport Unlocked. Hello and welcome to the podcast with the inside track on the week in sports news. I'm Rob Harris from the Associated Press, and alongside me as ever is Martin Ziegler from The Times. And we've had a bit of a busy end to the week, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, we thought it was all sort of done and dusted, then sort of Friday night sort of exploded into a massive ball of news, which we've spent having to report, and now we're analysing it. And fortunately, we have Tariq Panja of the New York Times with us again to help unravel what's actually happening.
Yeah, nice to join you guys on a rare busy week for European football.
Well, UEFA was heading into the weekend seemingly buoyed by reaching an agreement with nine of the rebel Super League clubs to disavow themselves from the breakaway. And we'll have details on that in a few minutes. But then this bombshell dropped from Downing Street, with the Transport Secretary Grant Shapps adding Turkey onto England's red list of countries just 3 weeks before Istanbul is due to host the All-English Champions League final. What does this all mean for Chelsea and Manchester City and their fans? Let's take a listen to Grant Shapps.
So I'm afraid we are having to put Turkey on the red list, and this will have a number of ramifications. And first of all, it does mean, I'm afraid, with regard to the Champions League, that fans should not travel to Turkey. The FA, I can tell you, are in discussions with UEFA already on this. We are very open to hosting the final, but it is ultimately a decision for UEFA. Of course, it's worth mentioning the UK's already got a successful track record of football matches with spectators, so we're well placed to do it. And I have spoken to the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport this afternoon about this. So we're very open to it. It is actually, in the end, a decision for UEFA to make.
So uncertainty now about whether or not Istanbul can host the Champions League final. Fans are banned from going there. Only essential travel is allowed. And anyone who does return to the country would have 10 days mandatory hotel quarantine in England. So, Martin, what is going to happen to the Champions League final?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, Istanbul can host a Champions League final still. I think it's quite likely that the British government will give exemptions to the players and staff of the clubs if they stay in the bubble. So what we would have is a situation with the teams going to Istanbul as planned, but there would be no fans going. I mean, on one level that seems pretty bad, but on another level, actually, we've had a year where we're quite used to fans not being able to access matches. And if it was only local fans able to attend, that's probably not the worst thing in the world. Perhaps we should accept that as a solution. Moving it to England is not easy. I know it's easier for the fans to attend, and it's easier for the clubs, but it's not straightforward for UEFA. It's not straightforward for international broadcasters. It's not straightforward for sponsors. And it's certainly not straightforward for the Turkish authorities, who've been planning for this for the best part of 3 years. So looking from a sort of broader perspective, I think we have to accept that these things, whatever the choice is, there is no easy answer.
Both those clubs have got massive fan bases based on their sponsorship agreements, etc., from all around the world. So presumably there will be thousands of supporters wearing the light blue of Manchester City and dark blue of Chelsea, who can come from elsewhere outside of England.
Well, the most logical thing would be just to play the game in England. Obviously, the Championship playoff is already due to take place on May the 29th at Wembley, so that would have to be moved. The whole weekend has got the playoffs. And really, Wembley is probably the main English option because it's already geared up for the Euros. It's got the UEFA infrastructure there, the broadcast facilities. I mean, obviously, there are other venues in the UK that could hold the game. You've got Millennium Stadium Cardiff, which held the final in 2017. You've got Hampden Park, which is already going to be a Euros venue as well in June. But I think if it was to come to England, Wembley would be the main option. The question is whether or not UEFA is so determined to keep it in Turkey, having already taken the final off Istanbul last year and moved it to Lisbon.
Yeah, politically for Istanbul, they already fought really hard to take it away from Istanbul last year when they had that final knockout tournament staged in Lisbon, which was relatively successful. They managed to play those games, obviously all of those without supporters. But you mentioned Wembley, but England has a bunch of stadiums that are kind of first class Champions League level stadiums. You have in London, you have the Emirates Stadium, you have Tottenham's new stadium, and then outside of London, you have Old Trafford and others as well. And we're talking about being able to accept 10,000 fans. Is that right, Martin? Is it more than that, or is it about 10,000?
Well, I mean, under the rules, it's 10,000, but the FA Cup finals having more than 20,000 because it's got a special status as a test event. So you could have more. I actually think what's going to happen, the most likely thing is it will remain in Istanbul because I think that's what UEFA want. There's going to be a lot of pressure brought to bear, and I'm sure there'll be lots of stamping of feet by various people to say, oh, it should be in England. And it's straightforward. But on the other hand, if you're outside of the UK and you're planning to come to the UK, actually it's really, really difficult, which I don't think people perhaps realise. The restrictions on coming into the UK from elsewhere are really, really tough. So it's not easy to organise a Champions League final in England at the moment.
Martin, can I ask you how much of this is political? Like, this is, again, quite a populist approach. We heard from a minister that Rob mentioned, Grant Shapps, etc. We've had a election cycle this week in England and the United Kingdom. How much of this is to say, like, you know, wave the flag, etc., because they can, and because that seems to be the kind of popular approach to political life in the UK at the moment, to see which way the wind is blowing. And it is, we need English fans and English stadiums, etc. But like I kind of alluded to earlier, these teams are now global enterprises. Both Manchester City and Chelsea claim to have millions of fans overseas who are just as passionate as those locally. Perhaps they want to go to a final.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And there is a perception abroad that this is a very much a sort of British political decision. And this is the British government putting pressure on UEFA to get it changed. So, that sort of thing has got to be borne in mind. I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, we should do this for the fans, put the fans first. And it's an easy thing to say. It's a much more difficult thing to say, and actually it may not be the right decision. But I think that is the dilemma that UEFA is battling with at the moment.
All in all, a pretty busy week for the British government. The fact they managed to see off that battle with France over Jersey in just a few hours lasted even less than the war over the Super League a few weeks ago, which collapsed in 48 hours. And now we even have some news of settlements between 9 of the rebel clubs, but still 3 outstanding. UEFA on Friday night announcing that they've announced a reintegration process with the 6 English clubs: Arsenal, Chelsea, Liverpool, Tottenham, Manchester United and Manchester City, as well as Atletico Madrid and AC Milan and Inter Milan. It just leaves Barcelona, Real Madrid and Juventus holding out and now facing the threat of sanctions, a ban maybe from the Champions League. And as things stand now, the nine who have agreed to the settlement will have to hand over 5% of their UEFA revenue for a season, as well as collectively pay a 15 million euro fine, which will go to the UEFA Foundation. What do we make of these sanctions and the speed, actually, that UEFA seemingly brought the process to a close with the nine of the clubs?
Yeah, I think there's kind of a lot of detail in that announcement from UEFA tonight with the nine clubs, etc. But no one's been really wounded, have they? 15 million among nine of those for a foundation, which is quite nice. It's hardly kind of crumbs for the clubs we're talking about. And the interesting thing, I thought, was the 50 million to 100 million euro potential penalty should they look to break away in the future, and the promise to not take part in any litigation against UEFA or FIFA. I think those are the most important elements of this, those that kind of golden handcuff them to the current pyramid and the European settlement that we've had for decades. Would you say so, guys?
Yeah, certainly in terms of the financial penalties. The some of the other Premier League clubs have looked at these, and I understand and think it's fairly derisory. So yeah, probably the future possible penalties are more important.
But also, I wonder what this means for. They mentioned nine teams. They leave out three, who are Real Madrid, Florentino Perez, Juventus, Andrea Agnelli, Barcelona, and Juan Laporta, the new president of Barcelona. Those three are clearly convinced that they still have a case that they're willing to pursue against UEFA. They already launched a case as the Super League against what they believe was monopolistic practices by UEFA that are blocking them from launching a Super League, and those cases are ongoing, and the preliminary one, at least in Madrid, ruled in their favour, saying UEFA cannot punish them or block them from sort of carrying on until further discussions are held. What does this mean for those three teams?
Well, it's amazing that they perhaps haven't taken this settlement, but it shows that they probably want to save face as well. Florentino Perez not wanting to seem to capitulate, still wanting to seem to be the great leader of this Super League project, and not wanting to lose the battle of wills with Alexander Shefferin at UEFA. But the consequences could be severely damaging if UEFA do go ahead and impose the ban. On the flip side, if they get the ban and then challenge it, potentially a fuller hearing, whether it's ultimately at CAS, could hear out the arguments over whether they actually do have the right or not to form a Super League, which maybe could tilt in their favour more.
Martin, you're a Monty Python fan, if I remember right. Is this not the knight who had his arms and his legs chopped off and he carries on fighting? Is it not the case that this thing is doomed, but the few kind of stranglers are sort of fighting on?
Yeah, not just me, actually, who's that Monty Python fan, because actually Alexander Shefferin raised that as that particular image is to describe the Super League people who are hanging on in there. I thought it was actually fairly key that AC Milan have abandoned the fight, and that they are. So now it is just down to three, because that is a really significant moment, isn't it? I think personally.
Well, not only personally, Martin, the number of nine of the 12 is important from a kind of technical legal reason as well, because once you have nine of the 12 who withdraw from the Super League company, you're able to liquidate the actual company itself. And that's what the wobble was. If you once AC Milan had signed up to this declaration, that meant that the actual project on paper, at least, is officially able to be killed off. It's a dead parrot, Zeke. Now, if now others want to take on litigation on the basis, and I think there's some merit to this, that, you know, UEFA or FIFA or whoever are kind of monopolies that deserve scrutiny. That might be a lawsuit that is worth having for the greater good, not necessarily for this competition, but just about the role of UEFA and FIFA as regulators, as competition organizers and development organizations. Something that, you know, some of us talked about for a long time, that these three hats that UEFA wears and also FIFA wears don't make sense and seem very strange, anachronistic in the modern world that we live in, where they are also regulating and organizing competitions in which they are competing with leagues and teams for sponsorship revenue and TV revenue.
Well, as we reflect on the sports politics of it all, I really saw it on the ground level in terms of the fan anger on Sunday when I was outside Old Trafford as those protests got bigger and bigger, and they got violent ultimately very briefly, and Manchester United's game against Liverpool was postponed. And what I saw was a lot of animosity towards the Glazer family that's been bubbling up for 16 years, really deep concerns about the fact they took United into the Super League, and also over the money they've taken out the club from the debt that was loaded on it with the takeover. And there were some pretty hairy moments personally in terms of my safety outside Old Trafford as I was reporting on it. If anyone's seen some of the footage of some fans directly fighting with the police by a brick wall, it was shot on my phone where it erupted pretty quickly and unexpectedly. That's why I was so close to it. And the reason it's so short is immediately glass bottles started flying in, and then it was a cue to try and run for cover. But at that point, there was security and police pushing against us, glass bottles flying overhead, crunching glass, and a bag over my head as we tried to escape. And then still the police were determined to potentially try to baton attack me, which some people perhaps in sports governance would relish.
So were you more scared of the police than the protesters then, Rob?
You know, it happened so quickly that you try and sort of replay the moments. And the moment, I think you're seeing glass bottles flying overhead and you can hear them around you, you just don't know which direction they're going to go in. And it was a reminder really of actually how potentially dangerous it was, the fact that there was police officers, facial injuries, eye socket injuries, because, you know, United fans were chucking these bottles, which could have gone anywhere.
How did it flare up, Rob? And what kind of numbers are we talking about? Why did this kind of lead to that type of incident you mentioned?
That's the thing. It had been fairly routine for a couple of hours there, just sort of hovering around. They were just setting off flares, chanting, climbing on sort of side buildings. Some fans were inside the stadium looking out from the windows. But it was largely just a crowd that there was absolutely no sign of trouble. You know, speaking to some of the fans, like a guy in his 60s who's originally from Ireland, been supporting them for years and just wanted to protest against the Glazers. You know, absolutely someone, no intention of violence. You did start to see some fans arriving, drinking a bit more and causing a bit more, being a bit more boisterous. And then around 4 o'clock, which was half an hour from when kickoff should have been, more police started to arrive, which meant the area started to get a lot more congested. So whereas there'd been sort of breathing space around the edge of the concourse, suddenly it was quite intense. And there seems to be a moment when there was a confrontation face to face with the fans and the police, bit of goading, and that's when the police seemed to choose to go in more heavy-handed, and that was about 10 past four. And then that sort of inflamed the situation, and the police used that situation to then close off the area and start sort of sending a lot more reinforcements to disperse the area. The police horses went in, and then there were sort of skirmishes sort of down the street.
What kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Oh, it seemed definitely thousands outside. You know,
no,
definitely
involved, not outside, but involved in this melee or this issue.
Yeah, I mean, it was there was hundreds in the area at the time. still for sure, as certainly as bottles were being thrown in. The direct confrontation was about sort of, you know, only about 10 or so, but then it sort of did inflame the whole area, it seemed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, though. It shows that passions are still running high, despite the fact the Super League has been sort of effectively collapsed, that fans are still pretty unhappy with the situation. And it, even at a club where they've spent so much money on transfers, you can understand why the Glazers are unpopular, but it's not as though they haven't sort of funded big transfers and stuff like that.
It's interesting, the Super League has, for some element of contrition from the English clubs at least, Chelsea announcing that there will be fan representation in their board meetings going forward, and even a letter with a heavy PR touch from it on Friday from the Manchester United co-owner Joel Glazer, meeting a demand from the Supporters Trust to respond by Friday. He, you know, accepts there's a need for change at the club, that there will be better communication, even accepting that there will be investment in Old Trafford as well, because one of the criticisms of the fans has actually been the lack of spending on the actual infrastructure around the club that the Glazers have owned now since 2005. The Supporters Trust, though, saying that they'll only determine their actions based on what the words actually mean. They say we've seen empty words too many times previously, but it does seem the Glazers are sort of starting to engage finally with the fans.
Obviously, there's a lot of public relations in here, but I mean, I actually think this is a sort of fairly significant moment for football, for football's owners, for clubs, for UEFA, FIFA, everybody. I mean, I don't know what you think, but I actually think this is the sort of, in a way, it's the sort of biggest football story for many, many years. I mean, obviously the FIFA corruption scandal was a massive story. But in terms of like club football, this is probably the biggest, isn't it? I mean, I think it's
almost bigger than the FIFA story. See, it's a FIFA story in a political kind of weird global dimension was bigger. But really, in terms of what matters to millions of people around the world, it's club football, and particularly European club football. I think this is the biggest story we've had for a generation, if not more.
I mean, in terms of the actual failure of the breakaway, and now we've got these potential 100 million euro fines if a club tries to do it again, it should seem to take that threat off the table. And I think perhaps one interesting thing from the levels of fines that now clubs would face if they tried to join a Super League is, does that offer some financial security for UEFA if they're to take out some form of financing facility themselves, that actually it can be underwritten by the fact any club who try to leave would have to cough up a lot of money?
But no, you raise a really good point, because you know, Rob, that they are trying to get a load of financing. I understand UEFA is trying to get a €6 billion investment from outside capital in order to, I suppose, well, they wouldn't want to say pay off the rebels, but in order to kind of quiet the current situation where there is this issue of pandemic damage, etc. UEFA is trying to get outside investment to the value of €6 to 7 billion euros, which will be used as a kind of grant to teams that are struggling financially at the moment, and that income will be paid off through future European football income, be it Champions League or Europa League. And I suppose that is what everyone was looking for in order to get on a stable footing after the year or two we've had, Martin. There's been red ink all over balance sheets in Europe, England and elsewhere, right?
Yeah, absolutely there has. I mean, it's to me, though, if you're going to just take all your European earnings up front, that's just like kicking the can down the road, isn't it, in terms of sort of future problems and future competition with other clubs. I mean, I can see if you're absolutely up against the wall that, you know, that might be the only way forward. But is that the best long-term solution for a club, to take your future Champions League earnings up front? Because what's going to happen in 3 or 4 years' time?
The real solution really is about regulation, governance, and applying your rules. I think Javier Tebas at La Liga a couple of weeks ago said the issue isn't about raising more revenue, which was what the Super League promised for these teams. The real issue facing these clubs is about managing their costs, which is reducing the amount they spend on transfer fees and salaries, spending money that they haven't got in order to keep up with the others. And as far as UEFA is concerned, it's about enforcing its own rules, be it financial fair play or anything else that comes afterwards. I think one of the reasons, particularly for the American owners in English football and maybe AC Milan as well, was controlling the costs and having rules in place that punish those who broke those rules. And I think there was a degree of distrust in UEFA to enforce its own regulations.
And of course, we've seen the financial fair play cases over the years, Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, amongst those who reached settlements. Just a year ago, UEFA tried to kick Manchester City out of the Champions League for this season, and they've now reached the final after, of course, overturning that ban. They had their conduct criticised. And of course, while the clubs like Manchester City and the other Super League rebels have reached this agreement with UEFA, they still face investigation and potential sanctions from the FA and the Premier League. And we also know separately that Manchester City's case with the Premier League over potential financial fair play breaches is also still ongoing and in the midst of a legal system as well. So one thing in the UEFA statement was actually almost sort of appealing for leniency from the domestic FAs in terms of how they now pursue the Super League rebels that have come to this UEFA agreement. Because what UEFA statement said is, at the club's request, they're going to ask and support that due consideration be given by their respective national associations and national leagues to the spirit, content and purpose of the commitments given by the clubs to UEFA. So they sort of trying to say, look, we've sorted out the matter. England, Premier League, FA, you don't bother punishing them now.
Yeah, but it seems like a bit of a dance, doesn't it? It seems like a bit of a dance that suits UEFA. But at the end of the day, as far as the English Premier League is concerned, 14 teams in England are deeply frustrated and really annoyed with what happened here, and they deserve punishment on a domestic level. So UEFA is obviously assuaged by these teams' contrition and the fact that they're now willing to cooperate with them and are going to contribute to their Champions League. But that doesn't mean anything for the Premier League or any of the domestic leagues, quite frankly. And the issue the Premier League has in England, for example, is how do you punish these six clubs from England who threaten to destroy the value of their competition, the value of their clubs? Now, one of the reasons why this competition collapsed so quickly was because the fans of those teams protested so vehemently. They were out in the streets, etc. So how do you make a punishment that doesn't hurt the fans and those followers of the teams? So perhaps there's going to be some sort of financial resolution that doesn't hurt the clubs, the fans, or a points deduction, etc., but might hit the owners in their wallets. Martin, what do you reckon is going to happen here?
Yeah, there are some Premier League clubs who would like to have points deductions. I mean, that may be from purely naked self-interest. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think you're right. It's going to be fines, but probably heavy fines. And it looks like the UEFA, that they've sort of basically come to some sort of mutual agreement, haven't they, about, you know, what's acceptable to everybody. And the idea is they're going to try and put it to bed. But domestically, that won't wash. They'll have to take some sort of action. Or another aspect of this UEFA statement on this is the fact that all the clubs are going to rejoin the European Club Association, the ECA, which they left the day after the European Super League. Be interesting to see quite how much influence they get back, because
is it not dead? Is it not dead though, Martin? I mean, the idea that these nine teams 2 weeks ago did the dirty on the other 200 teams, half of them are on the board of the ECA. They totally flopped in what they tried to do. Now they're going to crawl back into the ECA because UEFA said so. So doesn't it tell you two things? Isn't UEFA now in control of the ECA? And two, how do the other clubs accept them back in a way that they're going to be honest brokers.
I mean, it's complete distrust. I don't know how in any way for some years they can trust any of the officials, if they are the same ones sent in by the clubs to these meetings to discuss things like the final stages of the changes to the Champions League from 2024, because there are still unresolved matters in terms of what does the Champions League look like from 2024, and how can these people actually know that honest dealings are taking place when they've tried to blow up the whole system?
I agree. I think that, in fact, the people who were on the board, so I think there'll be no place for Ivan Gazidis, for example, AC Milan, obviously no place for Florentino Perez or anyone from Real Madrid.
Andrea Agnelli, the president of the ECA.
Of course, Andrea Agnelli, they can't get anywhere near it. And nobody from Manchester United either, because Ed Woodward was on there too. But so I think, you know, we will see some of the rebel clubs get back on the board, but I don't think it'll be from any of those clubs who's represented before. So, you know, it wouldn't be a surprise to see somebody from Manchester City, maybe somebody from Liverpool, although Liverpool were fairly big movers behind the whole Super League idea.
They're trying to put everything back into place in a way like it was before, but it can never be the same again, surely, right? We also have those three clubs, Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus. Real Madrid, the biggest, the most successful team in the European Cup history outside of this. How do you put all of this back together?
Well, they've got to resolve it by August, because that's when we've got the Champions League group stage draw and they're going to be in it. And I imagine they will be in the Champions League next season. Surely they will eventually come to an agreement, but they can't get these same terms, surely, now, can they? Because they've held out for longer and they haven't been part of this peace pact. Or we get into another lengthy battle and the lawyers win and we're going through CAS again if they do try to ban them from the Champions League. But
what do you do with these three teams, guys?
Well, if I was in charge of UEFA, I would say I would just give them a deadline. So either you drop the Super League, sign the same commitments as the others, accept the punishment, come back into the fold by June the 1st, or that's it. You're not in the Champions League next season. That's what I would do.
And speaking of new tournaments, if you thought Super League was dead, think again. The Gulf Super League, powered by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and all its riches. There is civil war in golf circles at the moment. Rory McIlroy has branded the competition a money grab. We've heard that those sort of words before when it comes to football. And the PGA Tour has threatened to ban rebels who sign up to the proposed breakaway. We've heard that type of threat before as well. Martin, this money from Saudi Arabia for sport, there was some suggestion, we mentioned it last week as well, that there could have been some Saudi money involved in the Football Super League project. It's kind of shaking up world sport at the moment, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, the golf thing is incredible. And actually, you're talking about players. I mean, they're already incredibly well rewarded, aren't they? Golf professionals, the ones at the top of the game, I should say. The prize
money. They're all multimillionaires.
Yeah, but they're still going to double their income. So, not surprisingly, there's a lot of interest in this, even though Rory McIlroy is saying it's a money grab. At the end of the day, if most people in the world, if they're offered a chance to double their money, would probably take it.
The figures you're mentioning are between 30 and 50 million up front to sign up for this Saudi Super League golf project. And it is huge money. But again, yes, I suppose people would take it, but then you can use the argument in the same way that the big elite football clubs could make and say, this is huge money and we should take it as well. And then you've got the rest of the sport to consider. And I guess it's where you place sport as a kind of activity beyond a business activity, right? Again, it's kind of feels like the similar type of arguments, but maybe, you know, golf is calibrated differently and there are elite golfers and there's a few of them and they go around. There aren't, I guess, millions of supporters who who, you know, get a Rory McIlroy tattoo on their calf like you would a Man United or a Man City tattoo. Maybe the following is different. So this might have more legs.
You know, and it has obviously been talk of any repercussions for players who do break away to join this competition, which Amnesty pointed out, while all the talk at the present is of potential sanctions for players, their statement continued, golfers should also consider the effects of Saudi sports washing and their role in it. And they're saying any player attempts to join should speak out about human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia and counter the effects of sports washing. Because, I mean, this is something we hear a lot about Saudi Arabia at the moment with boxing and Formula E, obviously about trying to cleanse the image of a country where, you know, we are still discussing the fallout from the complicity of Mohammed bin Salman in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And I was thinking about it because obviously, particularly with the Qatar World Cup approaching, Manchester City in the Champions League final, we hear a lot about sports washing there. Now, I think actually when they started these endeavours, when they launched the World Cup bid, when Abu Dhabi bought Manchester City, there wasn't necessarily sports washing because we weren't talking about human rights abuses in those countries at the time. It was more about projection of image and power. And perhaps it's afterwards that they've actually sort of seen the need to sort of use the events to gloss over their abuses in their country.
That is a remarkable amount of naivety if they didn't think there'll be this sort of laser focus on what's going on in their countries. Maybe they thought because it's so shiny and we're going to spend so much money on these things, everyone's going to think we're brilliant. But that is just really naive.
Because we weren't talking about these issues when Manchester City...
Most people had never heard of Qatar, let's be honest. Mm. I mean, until 2009, how many stories had you written, Martin, Rob, with the word Qatar in it? And think how many stories you've mentioned that word since in the last decade. So yeah, I mean, it could be any country as well. It's not necessarily those. I mean, there's human rights abuses all over the world. Like if Myanmar got the Champions League final next week, what do you think we're going to be writing about?
Yeah.
And of course, Baku with games at Euro 2020, Wales are playing there, for instance, in their group. So there will be talk about Azerbaijani human rights issues as we had when they hosted the Europa League final a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the Saudis have gone taking this sport washing to another level, but lots of, you know, it's not just recently we've had dictatorships or dubious regimes wanting to host international sporting events. I mean, look, you know, we look back to Argentina 1978 World Cup, football World Cup, all these sorts of things, and even this, even in the last month, we've had UEFA awarding a junior women's tournament to Belarus, which has got very, very...
It's got the last dictator in Europe in charge, I believe, Martin.
That's right. Thank you. I was struggling for his name there, Tariq.
I'm sure you Mr. Lukashenko.
That's right, yeah. And we've had official opposition to this from the International Footballers Players Union, FIFPro. So it's still a really, really big issue. And I think international governing bodies, have to be very, very careful about the decisions they take. And as we've seen with the Winter Olympics in Beijing next year, all sorts of places.
Yeah, and looking ahead to the more immediate Olympics in 11 weeks' time in Tokyo, there are new concerns, as we've talked about so often on the pod, about Japan's ability to stage the Olympics and Paralympics. The Tokyo area has had the state of emergency orders extended this week until the end of May, and now there are questions over whether or not the IOC president can even go ahead with a planned visit to Japan, with the organisers saying that it could be quite tough for him to come at the moment. It's really looking problematic, isn't it, out there in Tokyo?
Yeah, it's looking a bit grim for Tokyo, isn't it? I mean, we're just around 11 weeks away from the start. And they're in the grip of this emergency situation. Vaccine levels are really, really low. We have got some test events there this weekend. Seb Coe is meant to be going out for an athletics event. Thomas Bach, as you say, is due to visit. But it's not looking easy. In fact, it's increasingly difficult. I still think there's a risk it doesn't take place at all. But I think, as we've said before, maybe behind closed doors is now the most likely prospect.
And we've got the Pfizer vaccine announcement. Rob, do you think there was a reason for that to be announced this week, given the kind of distrust and lack of interest from the and opposition from the Japanese public? Do you think that might have played into some of this?
Well, the IOC had been insisting for some time that no athletes would be jumping the queue for vaccines, and maintaining that people being vaccinated wasn't going to be a requirement for taking part in the Olympics. And we've seen the position shifting over some time. And now they've said that Pfizer and BioNTech have donated vaccines for all Olympic athletes and officials who are going to be going there. And of course, this comes at a time when, as we've seen, a country like India is struggling to get a vaccination program rolled out, even though, of course, quite a few of the vaccines are made there. The AstraZeneca vaccine is made there.
Well, in fact, in Japan, only like 2% of the Japanese population is vaccinated at this moment in time as well. So that seems a bit strange. Again, it's this issue of giving healthy athletes, healthy young people vaccines ahead of perhaps people who need them more elsewhere. But I guess if that's to give the Japanese public concern, comfort that you know they're not going to have all of these people entering their country who could spread this really dangerous virus.
Yeah, it's a difficult decision for the politicians in Japan as well, because what do you do when you have 80% opposition levels? You have hundreds of thousands of people signing petitions wanting the Olympics to be cancelled. They're almost caught between a rock and a hard place, because it's on the one hand, they desperately want to use all these facilities they've spent billions and billions of pounds building, otherwise it looks like a waste. On the other hand, if it's going to be a vote loser, what politician wants to go ahead and do that?
We're talking about whether or not these games will go ahead, and we had a bit of word this week about whether or not the Olympics will be back in London, not this year as a plan B, but in 2040. And anyone who's been listening to the podcast throughout since we began in January, this won't be anything new to them, will it? Because we'd already flagged this potential up.
We had. And now there's Sadiq Khan saying he would set up an exploratory committee to look at either the 2040 or even the 2036 Olympics. This would be on a UK-wide basis, based in London, so using all the existing 2012 facilities. But, for example, using the Birmingham Commonwealth Games venues, some of the Glasgow 2014 Commonwealth Games things. And, I mean, it'd be unprecedented, wouldn't it, return quite so quickly. But we had Craig Reedy on, didn't we, a few weeks ago, the British IOC member, who said it may be that the way the IOC is changing its selection process and looking on a nationwide basis instead of just a city basis, that they might be quite attracted to it. The other thing is who's going to be in opposition, because it's so expensive now that not many places can actually hold it, especially if you're talking in the midst of recovering from a global pandemic. Maybe not that many places are actually thinking of the Olympics.
And we told you in a previous episode of Sport Unlocked how the IOC basically scrapped the bidding process for the 2032 Games and awarded it with a behind-the-scenes process effectively to Brisbane. Of course, if you subscribe to Sport Unlocked, you can listen back to all the older episodes where we try to bring you the key talking points first. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode. Tarek, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, nice to be with you. Nice to try and draw a conclusion to this kind of Super League fiasco, which I think will be with us for a few more weeks, Martin.
Well, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it's going to be longer than that. But yeah, interesting. I think by this time next week, we should know where definitively the Champions League final is going to be staged. But interesting to just put ourselves on the spot and just one word. Where do you think the 2021 Champions League final is going to be staged? I will start. I think it is still going to be in Istanbul. Rob?
I would say not in Turkey.
I will say it will remain in Istanbul.
I'm outvoted 2-1 if we had the decision to be making ourselves on this exco of Sport Unlocked. Thanks a lot, and particularly for everyone for listening as ever. And if you're enjoying us, please subscribe to us, review us on whichever platform you're getting your pods on. And you can always message us via Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. We're at Sport Unlocked. Enjoy your sports viewing in the days ahead, and we'll speak to you soon. Goodbye for now.